Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And happy Thanksgiving, my friends. A beautiful day. Hopefully, wherever you are, it is here in the Northwest, in the People's Republic of Portland, Oregon. Happy Thanksgiving to David Poole, one of our producers in the chat room. He says, happy Thanksgiving to the folks in the chat room. Greetings to you all. Happy Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving to our listeners. And we're going to be talking as we go through the day, through the next 3 hours of this program, about what you're thankful about, what I'm thankful about, what various people are. We're going to have Euron Brook from the Ayn Rand Group next hour. He's going to tell us that we should all be thankful for capitalism and the wonders of it. And more money, and that should be what it's all about to be thankful for. But first, it not only is it Thanksgiving Day, but it is also the date today is the 24th of November. And the 24th of November is the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was killed after following the Kennedy assassination, 2 days after Kennedy was assassinated. And I didn't want to let that anniversary pass without a bit of a discussion about Lee Oswald. We got a lot of response to when we had Lamar on, my co-author, with this book that just came out recently about the Kennedy assassination. And Lamar is back with us again. And Lamar, welcome to the program. I think. I'm not hearing Lamar. There we go. Lamar? Nope, I'm still not hearing Lamar. So in a minute when we get Lamar on, we'll be talking about the book Ultimate Sacrifice and how it works. And Lamar, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, great. Good to have you.
Hey, good to be here, Tom.
And by the way, I also want to say I'm thankful for Alex and Dan in New York at Air America Radio who are mixing our show today and who showed up. It's so great to have people and Louise here in the studio. And I'm thankful to you, Lamar. We've been friends for 20 years, more or less, and worked on this book together for a number of years. And then you carried the torch for the last decade, did a brilliant job of putting it together. Tell me the story of Lee Oswald. Was he the guy who shot Jack Kennedy?
No, he's not. And we actually came to determination by kind of an unusual route I'd like to set your listeners up with first. We actually talked, you and I both, with almost two dozen Kennedy insiders who had never talked about certain events before surrounding the assassination. That led us to thousands of pages declassified in the National Archives, documents anyone can look at. And they told us a story that led us to the Kennedy assassination solution and to Lee Harvey Oswald's role in it, because we uncovered the fact that John and Robert Kennedy had a secret, never-before-revealed plan to stage a coup against Castro and invade Cuba on December 1st, 1963, just 10 days after Dallas. But three mafia godfathers being prosecuted by Bobby Kennedy infiltrated that top-secret Kennedy coup plan and used parts of it to try and murder JFK in a way that would force key government officials into a cover-up to protect that coup plan. And they first tried this in Chicago 3 weeks before Dallas, then again in Tampa just 4 days before Dallas, before finally succeeding in Dallas. And that cover-up is why so much has been secret for so long, and also explains Lee Harvey Oswald's role in the assassination, and also explains who really did kill JFK.
So now we're back again to Lee Oswald. Did Lee Oswald kill Jack Kennedy is the question, I think, in a lot of people's minds. Gerald Posner came out with his book, Case Closed, that got a pile of media coverage. It was like wall-to-wall for weeks. Yes, Oswald was the lone gunman. Arlen Specter was right. And it's not exactly what we found.
No, and people are going to learn so much new about Lee Oswald and the other patsies in the other city, because, of course, there wasn't one assassination attempt by these three mafia godfathers against JFK. There were three, and there was a patsy in each of those cities, and each of those patsies had links to Lee Harvey Oswald and parallels to Oswald. But I guess the best place to start with Lee Harvey Oswald is to help people understand, you know, who he was and what he was really up to that day is It's probably back when he was a teenager.
Yeah, but just to establish from the very beginning, the thing that there's a relative certainty of, or certainly preponderance of the evidence, let's say,
sure,
is that there were, in all probability, four hitmen in Dealey Plaza that day, probably two behind the grassy knoll and two up on the sixth floor of the depository. In all probability, the two up on the sixth floor of the depository were French assassins who were brought in, who were deported out that night. And the two on the grassy knoll, we have a pretty good clue as to who they are. And none of those four people, in all probability, was Lee Oswald.
That's right. Lee Harvey Oswald was down on the lower floor of.
He was on the second floor, wasn't he?
Could have been on either of those floors, but he was eating his lunch and in all probability was waiting on a phone call about going to Cuba, which is exactly what had happened to the Tampa Patsy just a few days earlier.
Right. And in fact, he was sitting there with a Dallas police officer, was he not?
No. The Dallas police officer came in right after the assassination
and saw
Oswald down in the lunchroom.
Right.
And he was calmly drinking a Coke. So he had had to. So according to the Warren Commission, he had had time to shoot the president, hide his rifle. The elevators were not working, run all the way down, get one of those old-fashioned Coke machines to definitely work. Sometimes your Coke's got stuck in those days. Get the Coke out and then catch his breath and be calmly drinking just 30 seconds or so after the assassination.
Yeah, so a little bit of a stretch, shall we say. Okay, so who was Lee Oswald and how did he get dragged into this thing?
Well, one of those mafia godfathers that tried to kill JFK was the one based in New Orleans, whose territory extended into Dallas. But Oswald had grown up in New Orleans without a father. While he was a teenager, he really looked up to his two older brothers, both of whom were in the military. One was in military intelligence. Now, the Warren Commission would have us believe that Oswald was a teenage communist, teenage Marxist, and yet the evidence clearly shows this teenage communist joined the Civil Air Patrol, not a real common thing for a lot of teenage communists in those McCarthy days. Not only did Oswald join the Civil Air Patrol, Oswald joined the U.S. Marines, and not only did this young teenage communist join the Marines, he tried to join the Marines a year early before he was even old enough.
I think we should say so-called young teenage communist, because it's really clear that Lee Oswald believed himself to be a patriot, was very committed to the United States, and in fact, from all the evidence, was involved in U.S. military intelligence operations.
Well, that's exactly right, because when he was growing up in his early, formative teenage years, looking up to his military brothers, one of whom was not only in military intelligence, but was in a branch, I believe with the Coast Guard, that worked at finding communists. And the big shows in those McCarthy era, in that McCarthy era, was a TV show called I Led Three Lives.
Right, this was a big show in the late 50s. In the early 50s.
Mid 50s, rerun. And Oswald's brother tells us this was his favorite show, and Oswald watched it into reruns about a seemingly normal man who seemed to be a communist, but was really a very deep cover for years. This is important, for many years for the FBI. One of the popular radio shows at the time was I Was a Communist for the FBI, also a popular movie. So in those McCarthy years, for someone like Lee Oswald, above average intelligence, 120 IQ, but had some learning disabilities, had a troubled family life, as for his brothers, the military was a way out, and so he actually went into the U.S. military, and when he came out of the U.S. military, was one of several young men who went to Russia around the same time, most of whom later returned with a Russian wife, and then
these guys all learned Russian in Japan at Natsugi Air Force Base, was it not?
Well, and again, your listeners can ask themselves too. We've all seen at least movies and TV shows about the U.S. Marines, and Oswald was quite open in the Marines, going around speaking Russian, which he supposedly learned on his own, talking about how great Russian was, so much that his buddies called him Oswaldovich, and yet, none of his Marine sergeants or officers ever wrote him up for that activity. Again, in the late 50s, and he was at a U-2 base in Japan, and the U-2 was incredibly secret then.
And this is where Oswald was.
I'm sorry, what?
And this is where Oswald was.
Right, at the U2 base.
At this top secret U2 base. And from there, he defects to the Soviet Union, and we just kind of shrug our shoulders and say, well, that's cool. And in fact, when he defects back to the United States, Senator John Towers, the guy who brings him back.
Well, and we cite...
And he's never debriefed by the FBI.
And we cite information for the book, in the book, for the first time, that when Oswald returned to the U.S. with his Russian wife, that he was under tight surveillance by U.S. naval intelligence. And that means, you know, his phone, his mail, people around him, which finally explains the swirl of people around him. They were using Oswald and his wife as a dangle. They wanted to see how the KGB would try to recruit Oswald or his wife in the United States.
Right, and in fact, his wife was the daughter of a KGB colonel.
Well, actually, I think it's the MVD, which is somewhat different
right.
from KGB.
But close to it, the intelligence service of the Soviet Union. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. Lamar and I wrote a book called Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK. Today, the anniversary, not only of Thanksgiving, but the day Oswald was killed.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Some days I think of those turkeys in Texas, the way they'd all gobble when old Bill raised his voice.
That would be Bill Clinton.
And it's sad you could get that reaction. Of course, them being turkeys, well, they hadn't much choice.
And welcome back, my friends. Happy Thanksgiving to you. 21 minutes past the hour. We're broadcasting live coast to coast on Thanksgiving Day. We'll be back here tomorrow as well with the live program. And today, in addition to being Thanksgiving, is also the 24th of November, the day that Lee Harvey Oswald was killed, 2 days after Jack Kennedy was killed. And we're talking, with Lamar Waldron, who wrote Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK. And I'm the sort of co-author on this book. Not sort of. I am the co-author on this book. You and I did the research on this thing together to a large extent.
That's right, Tom.
So we were talking about Lee Harvey Oswald. Let's take a quick call here, Lamar. Lynn in Eureka, California has a question for us. Hey, Lynn, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Well, first of all, congratulations on your book. I'll have to wait for the paperback, however. It strikes me that...
Should be in libraries, Lynn, by the way.
There's that, yeah. It strikes me that the History Channel had a series of, four or five shows, which they came up with their conclusion of what happened in the Kennedy assassination. It sounds
Lamar and I were about 20 minutes of one of those, the last one, called The Men Who Killed Kennedy.
That was my question. Because it sounded like they came up with a very similar conclusion, and I thought maybe you guys had some influence on it.
Yeah, that was us actually coming up with that conclusion, and if you rent or buy the DVD, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, Lamar and I are the last 20 minutes of it, more or less. So,
okay, very good.
It's right there. And we lay out some of the documents and some of the stuff that ultimately led to this book. Anything you want to add to that, Lamar?
Sure. One interesting thing about it, that was filmed in the fall of 1994 before most of the documents had been declassified. Millions were declassified in the 90s. A million are still secret. But in other words, we're on the record, on TV, talking in the broad general outlines about this story years before the documents came out, because we didn't piece the story together from those documents. We were told the story by almost two dozen Kennedy insiders, and then actually helped with an awful lot of people behind the scenes to identify those documents and get them declassified.
And that was 11 years ago.
Right.
Yeah. Thanks, Lynn, for the call.
You bet. Thanks, Tom. Bye.
Yep. Good to hear from you. 1-866-440-THOM, by the way, if you have other questions or comments. So, Lamar, we were talking about Lee Oswald. He really was the patsy.
Right, and he was in Dallas a year before the assassination under this tight surveillance by naval intelligence. And get this, Tom, your listeners will love this. So Oswald is one of several young men sent into Russia, come back with Russian wives, so that U.S. intelligence, naval intelligence working with the CIA, can see how the KGB might try to recruit them. So at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, to make Oswald even more irresistibly attractive to the KGB, Oswald gets a job in Dallas at a map firm, a firm that helps to make maps based on, get this, U2 spy plane photos. And yet the KGB, which probably doesn't have a lot of people in Dallas anyway, was a little too suspicious, and they didn't even bite at that. So So by early 1963...
Right, now, let me just rephrase that, Lamar.
Sure.
So Lee Oswald is working in Dallas, this guy who defected from the Marine Corps after he studied the Russian language at the top-secret U-2 base in Japan, defected from there into the Soviet Union, said, I'm a communist, make me a communist. They stuck him in Minsk. They got him a job in a radio factory. He was like the frustrated spy who couldn't shoot straight. They married him off to the daughter of a an intelligence officer, intelligence colonel.
I believe she was the niece, Tom.
Niece, okay, thank you. And she comes back, and he and she come back to the United States. John Tower brings him back in. He's never debriefed by the FBI. John Tower goes on to be the Secretary of Defense. I mean, you know, all this stuff is just so conspicuous. And so to try to get the KGB to call him up and say, hey, you want to spy for us? Because that's really, I mean, you know, his job is to be a spy for the United States, but to pretend that he's a spy for the Soviet Union so
right.
that he can be a, you know, he's leading that triple life. They give him a job in a map factory working on the maps from the U-2 spy planes. He's handling top secret, highly classified information. That's his day job. And it still isn't enough to get the KGB interested, but I would think that would cause most Americans to say, I really don't think this guy was a communist sympathizer.
Well,
or at least I don't think the government thought he was a communist sympathizer.
And again, we have to remember, too, Tom, it's much easier for us 40 years later when we're past those Cold War times. You know, in that Cold War era when people believed everything the government said in the early 60s before Watergate and Vietnam flared up so big and people trusted everything the press said, you know, there was just a lot of ink spilled about, you know, the communist Oswald. Now looking back, it seems very obvious to younger people, but so the bottom line is the KGB didn't bite. Oswald moved from one city controlled by one of the three mafia godfathers who penetrated the Kennedy secret coup plan and moved
That'd be
to
New Orleans.
Another city, moved to New Orleans. And
right.
and in New Orleans, now these three mafia godfathers, Roselli of Chicago, Traficante of Tampa, and Carlos Marcello of Louisiana and East Texas, now they had 12 men that infiltrated the Kennedy's top secret coup plan. They're even in documents talking about it. Six of them actually worked on it, including two names that will be familiar to both assassination scholars and anyone who saw the JFK movie. That includes Guy Bannister, who was played by Ed Asner, and David Ferry, who was so effectively played by Joe Pesci, were working for Carlos Marcello and U.S. intelligence with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Yeah, these guys who had been, they were in both operations. They were part
exactly.
of Bobby Kennedy's operation. They were the mob, basically.
Right, exactly.
And had infiltrated the thing. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. Lamar, stick around. We'll be back. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
Hey there. You're a chicken.
Uh-oh.
And I'm a turkey. And here is my love song, just to you. I love your wings. I love your feet.
Oh, no.
You do those things. They're so unique.
Oh, those turkeys.
I love your eyes, the way you walk. I love your voice, the way you squawk. I'm so alone and rude. Come be my own, and love me too. You need to know about my love. Hey, where'd you go, my turkey dove? Hey, where'd you go?
Uh-oh.
My
turkey Where'd that turkey
dove?
Go? He's on somebody's table for Thanksgiving. Oh, no.
Another one flies the coop.
There you go. Another one takes off. Welcome back, my friends. Happy Thanksgiving. It's 35 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman. We're talking with Lamar Waldron. He and I... spent 7 years researching this book. It's 17 years altogether. Lamar spent the last 10 years finishing up the work and writing the book, Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba, and The Murder of JFK. The book is out. It just came out last week. And no speculation in this book. This is our commitment here in putting this thing together was to be historians rather than JFK assassination buffs. And it's just very, very solid. So, Lamar, we were talking about this. We've got a bunch of callers who want to get in and ask you questions. So let's just tighten this up really fast.
Sure.
Lee Oswald, he's an intelligence asset for the United States. He's under surveillance by naval intelligence. He clearly isn't the guy who shot Kennedy. The question that everybody asks is, okay, what about the photo of him holding the Daily Worker and his rifle? How, you know, why did he bring the rifle into work that day? How did he get set up as the patsy so that, you know, he'd take the fall for the Kennedy killing? He was working for Bobby Kennedy and for the CIA in this operation to go into Cuba, and at the same time, the mob was manipulating him. So, you know, give us the details on
that. That's exactly right. And the book lays all this out with extensive documentation from the National Archives, sources close to the Kennedys, and it's all very well documented because you're exactly right. He was being pulled from two directions. As 1963...
Only he didn't realize it.
Exactly right. As 1963 progressed, the Kennedys were making more and more plans about Cuba, including the one that we revealed for the first time, this coup plan about invading Cuba and staging a coup on December 1st. And plans for that were being made throughout much of 1963. And Oswald was one of several U.S. intelligence assets being sent into Cuba in support of that. At the same time, Bobby was managing that program as Attorney General. He was prosecuting the Mafia Godfathers of Chicago, Tampa, and Dallas. And those mafia godfathers, using their people who had infiltrated this top-secret Kennedy plan, were able to manipulate Oswald and two other individuals who would have taken the fall when they first tried to kill JFK, the mafia godfathers. And that's what we want people to remember. It was the three mafia godfathers of Chicago, Tampa, and Dallas used the secrecy around this secret plan to try and kill JFK first in Chicago. Then in,
on November 1st,
finally in Dallas.
Then in Tampa on November 18th, and finally successfully in Dallas on November 22nd. And there were, in fact, these three patsies, and
right.
And the similarities are startling. I mean, people who were part of the operation, they were going to be smuggled into Cuba. They were, you know, some of them were working for Bobby Kennedy. I mean, just the whole thing.
Well, right, right. And in Chicago, there was an ex-Marine named Thomas Valley, and he had been involved in some anti-Castro operations. He had just moved into a YMCA, and he had several other parallels to Lee Oswald, and also Oswald himself. There was evidence we cite in the book of him or someone pretending him to be him trying to get to Chicago. But the real assassins in Chicago, as in Dallas, were a four-man team, you know, working for the mafia godfathers.
Now, professional hitmen.
Right, exactly. The mafia would depend on professionals, not someone like Oswald. However, the Kennedys and the Secret Service found out about that attempt. In that case, the patsy was apprehended. The four men were not. They were at large. So at the last minute, and there's an awful lot about this in the book. And I talked to
Kennedy canceled the motorcade. Yeah, I don't want to go down that road, Lamar. I want to stay on Oswald here today because we've talked about that on this program, first of all, before. Secondly, it's in the book. People want to read it.
Sure.
The question that people have is, you know, if Lee Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, who did? The easy and short answer, there are four hitmen who were brought in. We identify them in the book. You can find, you know, the information, the whole background, who they were. I tracked one of them down in France. It was a wild ride. And the reason why Oswald was willing to get back to the answer to that question that I kind of rhetorically asked at the beginning, the reason why Oswald posed for that picture was because he thought he was being manipulated by the mafia, who he thought was his CIA handlers or had some relationship to his Bobby Kennedy program handlers. He was trying to get into, you know, ingratiate himself with Castro so he could get a visa to get into Cuba to be part of this assassination or this overthrow of Castro. That was, you know, in his mind. And so, you know, having a picture taken with his rifle and his People's Worker daily, be a cool thing. I mean, that's going to make, it's going to look good.
Well, and as you experienced yourself, and your listeners would probably find fascinating, you yourself met with a Cuban exile who admits meeting with Oswald
Veciana
in Dallas, right, and a CIA agent, and they were talking about the assassination of Castro. And this Cuban exile admits meeting Oswald. But again, Oswald thought he was going into Cuba in support of this upcoming operation.
Right, right. He didn't realize that, you know, he had people from Bobby's operation feeding him information about what he should be doing, and he had people from the mafia representing themselves as being from Bobby's operation,
telling him what to do.
Hey, bring the gun into the sixth floor of the depository. Maybe a firecracker will go off. People will, you know, you'll be suspicious, and that'll cause Castro to think you're a cool guy, and we'll get you into Cuba easy.
Well, and in fact, those were the same people manipulating him, working for U.S. intelligence, and thus on a low level for Bobby Kennedy, but making far more money, and we even quote dollars and cents, working for the mafia. So the Chicago attempt had to be canceled because the motorcade got canceled. We flash ahead to Tampa. There's a young man there with a dozen parallels to Lee Harvey Oswald. In this case, the Secret Service find out about the assassination attempt. JFK continues his motorcade. Oswald is also linked to Tampa. But in this case,
there's a patsy in Tampa, and there's four hitmen, and Kennedy knows this and does the motorcade anyway.
Right. Because the events that day, as we outline in the book, are part of his coup plan. He has a special message to send that night. He can't.
He's got to send a coded message from his speech, so he can't cancel the thing.
Right.
Plus, he's got an election coming up. He doesn't want to look like a wimp. And people say, "Well, why didn't they put the bubble top on the car if they knew that there was a hitman out there?" The bubble top was not bulletproof. It was just to keep the rain off. But it wasn't a rainy day.
In contrast to that, I guess to show in case word of the attempt leaked, because it was all covered up at the time. JFK's even standing up through part of the motorcade. So then we flash ahead to Dallas. We've got Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas. Now the Tampa patsy, a young man, again, with a dozen parallels to Oswald, actually goes from Tampa to Texas. Unconfirmed reports place him in Dallas. But here's what he does. After the assassination, he goes into Mexico City, and on into Cuba. And we present much compelling evidence, including some from the Warren Commission and a secret memo that was published in their report. That's what Oswald thought he was doing on November 22nd.
He was defecting, seemingly,
to Cuba through Mexico City in support of this upcoming U.S. operation.
And part of the setup for that would be bringing the gun into the depository to establish his credentials, even though the CIA, you know, he thought the CIA knew that he was doing this. He was doing it at their request. It would make him look like he was really and truly a pro-communist, pro-Castro guy. So Castro would say, okay, fine, we'll let you in.
And so, whereas it was really, of course, the real shooters that day, and I'll detail those for your listeners now, because so while Oswald's in the depository getting ready for his what he thinks is his defection, there are four men in Dallas who are going to kill the president. Witnesses saw the two different men on the grassy knoll, two different men up on the sixth floor. I'll run down who those were for your listeners right now. One is a lot of evidence that indicates one was Johnny Roselli of the Chicago Mafia. Usually mob godfathers don't involve themselves in hits. That's why they're so hard to prosecute. But the first two attempts has failed. They really had to make it work this time. A lot of indications Roselli was in Dallas, and he was one of those four men. A Chicago hitman named Charles Nicoletti, who had been caught the year before in Chicago in a specially modified hit car, as detailed in congressional investigation.
Right, this is a guy, a professional hitman who thought he was James Bond.
Right,
and then the other two.
Well, and the one of the other ones is a Cuban exile working for the CIA that we talk about in the book. But probably the most interesting of the four men was named Michael Victor Mertz, and this is the man you went to France to try and track down.
Yeah, and he was deported from Dallas that night.
A CIA document shows that within hours of the assassination, Mertz, who created the French Connection heroin ring, had saved...
About which they made the movie.
I'm sorry, what?
About which they made the movie. I mean, the French Connection heroin ring that they made the movie out of was based on Mertz, who we believe was one of the shooters in Dallas, and Santo Trafficante, the guy who helped set this thing up.
That's exactly right. And Mertz and Roselli and Nicoletti, they all, and the Cuban exile, they all had ties to Jack Ruby. I mean, that in itself is a fascinating story too detailed to go into here.
Right. So what these guys did is they successfully infiltrated this operation that Oswald was actually part of. The Bobby was running off the shelf out of the White House, arguably illegally, to assassinate Castro or stage a coup in Cuba, put in place a friendly government, and Bobby, when he hears Oswald's name, he's got to be thinking, you know, geez, one of my guys just killed my brother. And he, in fact, calls up Haynes Johnson and says, what, Lamar?
Says, one of your guys did it. And Haynes Johnson was a Pulitzer Prize reporter in Washington meeting with one of Bobby's Cuban exiles at that very time.
There you go. Incredible. Ultimate Sacrifice is the book, John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK. Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, the authors. 9:45. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm a turkey killer. I don't care what the people say.
Oh, it's a turkey killer. Oh, no.
I'm a turkey killer. I don't care what the people say.
Yes. Amazing. I'm broadcasting this program from a studio where there's several other radio stations. I walked into one this morning, and they were on the air, and they go, "Oh, there's Hartman. He's the vegetarian. What are you going to eat?" You know, he's hassling me. Anyhow, welcome back to the program. 9 minutes before the hour. It's Thanksgiving. What we have to be thankful for, one of the things I have to be thankful for, is Lamar Waldron, the guy who is my co-author and does the work in writing Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, The Plan for a Coup in Cuba and the Murder of JFK. Next hour, we're going to have Robert Jensen of the School of Journalism at the University of Texas. Why aren't both parties open to an honest discussion about why top policymakers from both parties wanted war? And Robin Shanti, the coordinator of Sustainable Business Networks, how will buying locally during the holidays affect our communities? And finally, in the third hour of our program today, going to be a big program today, Yaron Brook of the Ayn Rand Institute is going to be telling us what he's thankful for. And so, anyhow, we're talking with Lamar Waldron. Lamar, let's get right to the phone calls here.
Sure.
1-866-440-8466. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. Nate in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Hey, Nate, welcome. You're live with Lamar and me.
Hey, happy Turkey Day to you guys.
Thanks, Nate.
Thank you. I've seen a documentary on public TV. Well, I've also seen the History Channel ones, too. But this one I've seen on, or public access, I should say. And it suggested that George Bush Sr. Has never accounted for his whereabouts and that he was a CIA worker, or operative at the time, and that they have all these little connections and...
Yeah, kind of bottom line, was George Herbert Walker Bush involved in the assassination, Nate?
Mm-hmm.
That's your question? Okay, Lamar, take a shot at that. I'd say no, but
yeah,
you can say that with a little more precision.
He did actually phone in a tip to the FBI that, and there are other indications he may have had some CIA intelligence role in the 60s, but we do know he was CIA director in the mid-70s when Bobby Kennedy's secret coup plan and the mafia's infiltration of it was being kept secret from a Senate committee looking into the CIA, again, not to hide the role of the CIA in the JFK assassination, but to cover up the intelligence failures which had allowed JFK to be assassinated. So
Bush administration intelligence failures once again.
Right.
So,
right,
what exactly a surprise.
Right.
Blaine in Shreveport, Louisiana. You're live with Lamar and I. Hey, Blaine.
Hey, how you doing this morning?
Good.
That's some pretty fascinating stuff. You know, I've always believed that, I forgot his name. Oswald was not alone, but it's an interesting premise you've laid down. And I have, you know, everything I've ever seen or read to documentaries, to the Hollywood spin on it, suggests that the Kennedys gave assurances to the USSR they would not overthrow or assist in the overthrow of Castro, but you're suggesting that within a month later they're going to risk...
Well, in fact, it's really interesting. After the Cuban Missile Crisis, conventional wisdom is that Jack Kennedy said, "We won't invade." And actually what he said is, "We won't invade if you'll allow verifiable inspections by UN weapons inspectors." In fact, he was the first person to use the phrase weapons of mass destruction. And Castro refused to do that. So we had no promise not to invade.
Oh, okay. I've always been under the impression that we gave him
it's a common thought, Blaine, and it's incorrect. Dave in Eureka, California. Hey, Dave, you're live with Lamar and I.
Gentlemen, you may have come to the same conclusion that I'm voicing here, but these four hitmen had to be acting at the behest of power elites in our own government. They had no ability whatsoever to create a cover-up commission or to silence as many people as were silenced.
Well, yes and no, Dave. The cover-up actually was initiated by Bobby Kennedy. And
let me explain that, Tom. Yeah. It's so incredible because this is new information in our book for the first time. Days and weeks before Dallas, Bobby had a top-secret committee making plans regarding, and this is a quote, regarding the possible, quote, assassination of American officials, end quote, if Castro found out about the coup plan and tried to retaliate. So much of what we think of as the cover-up had actually been in the planning stages and being talked about by Bobby Kennedy and trusted officials that he trusted. But remember, the mafia infiltrated this plan, those three godfathers. And so what we think of as the cover-up, and Bobby Kennedy was at the autopsy that night. Tom's talked to one of the gentlemen with Bobby at the autopsy. I've talked to another one. So everything you hear, for instance, about the autopsy and all the unusual things and Kennedy's missing brain, that was Bobby Kennedy. So again,
Let me just toss this out in real short form because we're almost out of time here, Lamar. The reason for this was because when Bobby Kennedy and Jack Kennedy put together this operation to overthrow Castro, they were, number one, afraid Castro would find out about it, and number two, afraid that if he did, he'd try and retaliate by killing somebody in the United States. You're going to kill me, I'll kill you, kind of thing. They didn't think he was going to kill the president, but they were afraid that he might kill the ambassador to El Salvador or the governor of Louisiana or something. So they had this plan in place so that if Castro retaliated, that they would federalize it, they'd seize the evidence, they'd basically go into major cover-up mode because they knew that if the American people thought that Castro had successfully pulled off a hit on U.S. soil, the pressure would be so great, the political pressure, public pressure would be so great, they'd have to invade Cuba. And Khrushchev had already said, you invade Cuba, you got World War III. We're going to drop 1,000 nuclear bombs on you. And Kennedy was not willing to have all life on Earth end just over this thing with Castro. So as soon as Kennedy was killed, the initial indications were that this might have had something to do with the plot to get Castro, maybe even had something to do with Castro, and so immediately they went into cover-up mode to protect us from World War III.
Right.
Good summary?
And Tom, we have more information about that on the book's website, ultimatesacrificethebook.com, about the cover-up and how that had really begun well before the assassination and was controlled by Bobby Kennedy.
Yeah, and we lay out the documents that we found back 15, 16, 14 years ago, tracking this stuff down. Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman, the authors of Ultimate Sacrifice, John and Robert Kennedy, the plan for a coup in Cuba and the murder of JFK. Lamar, I am very thankful for you today. Thank you.
Hey, I'm thankful for you, and thanks for all these listeners for listening to us.
Amen. I'm right there with you. Thanks again, Lamar. Have a great, great Thanksgiving.
You too.
It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. Tom Hartman, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, broadcasting live coast to coast, border to border on radio stations all across the United States on Sirius Satellite Radio, on AirAmericaRadio.com, WhiteRoseSociety.com, RadioPower.org, CRN Digital, etc. Welcome back to our program. Pleased to have you with us. Robert Jensen is with us. Robert is with the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, and he has one of those websites that's so kind of long and strung out that the best thing to do is to put Robert Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, in quotes, into Google, and you will find it very quickly. Robert, welcome to our program.
Great to be with you, Tom.
Glad to have you with us. Robert is the author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. And your book and your writings in general, you illustrate or highlight this question, why are not both parties, the Republican and Democratic parties, open to an honest discussion about why top policymakers from both parties wanted war back in 2001, 2002?
Yeah, I think that's really one of the central questions. As you know, those of us who might be critical of the Bush administration, I don't know if you fit that category or not, Tom, but
I do.
You know, the Bush administration is so reactionary, such a radical departure from any sort of moral and political sanity, that it's easy to focus on them as the problem. And I think George Bush and this particular gang of thugs is a problem, but I don't think they're the problem. The problem lies in the project of American empire, which, of course, has gone on through Republican and Democratic administrations alike. We can see the complicity of mainstream Democrats in the run-up to the Iraq War and in similar enterprises throughout history. So I always think it's important to keep an eye on the failures of particular politicians, but also look at the structure of the system as well. And here, unfortunately, the news is not good in either the Republican or the Democratic camp.
Now, empire is something that has been really an ongoing debate among the politicians of this country since its founding. The founders originally were very clear that we were not only not about empire, we were pretty much not about messing with anybody, anywhere, anyhow, no matter what's going on. You know, it's just us here. And then, you know, by the end of the 19th century, McKinley was sort of into full empire mode, you know, with the USS Maine, the boiler blowing up and using that as an excuse to go to war against the Spanish and seizing the Philippines and whatnot. So we had our kind of flirtation with empire during the robber baron era. And then we kind of pulled back. There was all this pressure not to get involved in World War One. Woodrow Wilson had to invent public relations to sell us into World War One, and then we pulled back again, and then we get into World War Two. And now, am I accurately characterizing our dance with empire, or what am I missing here?
Well, actually, I would say that the United States has always been an imperial country, and we can split it into two sections. One is, as you point out, prior to 1898, the United States was, of course, building an empire, but it was building an empire on the North American continent. It was going to war against all the indigenous peoples, in fact, destroying, exterminating indigenous peoples to create the land base of this country. It was going to war with Mexico. So there was kind of, if you want to think of it in those terms, an internal empire-building phase.
Right.
And the minute the United States had the capacity to turn that military capacity outside of the continental U.S., it, of course, did, and we usually chart that as beginning with the Spanish-American War. Of course, U.S. empire-building really took off after World War II when all of Europe was decimated by that war, and the United States emerged as the dominant power. And in that case, U.S. empire building really reached a new level, and in some sense a level never seen before. The concentrated power and destructive capacity of the United States post-World War II really has never been rivaled in the history of the world. Now, it's important to note that the empire building of the U.S. post-World War II doesn't look like, for instance, the building of the British Empire or the French Empire. It doesn't go forward in traditional colonial fashion, but it's still, I think, empire building all the same. And even, you know, one of the interesting things, especially post 9/11, Tom, is that even conservative commentators are willing to acknowledge that empire is probably an appropriate term. The difference is, of course, they want to have us believe that, unlike any other empire in history, the United States is an inherently benevolent empire which acts in the interests of others.
Well, every empire in history has characterized itself as such.
Absolutely. The British, of course, had their white man's burden. The French had the civilizing mission. You know, the Belgians didn't, you know, just wake up one day and said, well, let's go destroy the Congo for our own purposes. There was a rhetoric of bringing civilization to the darker continent.
And well, and the founders even bought into this. I mean, in 1773, Jefferson published his tract on basically how to be a good citizen of the British Empire and what they would have to do in order to treat us well. I'm forgetting the title of it. It's a very long title. But
well, yeah, what this reminds us is nobody gets up in the morning and says, how can I be, you know, a nasty person and increase my own wealth and power at the expense of others? They wake up in the morning and say, how do I find a rhetorical justification for that very same activity? And here I think it's important to
note. Well, do you really think that that's the case, Robert? Or do you think that they wake up in the morning and say, it's a scary world, and the only way that we can be safe is if we put our foot on the throat of everybody around us who might harm us?
Well, you know, I think there are probably people who fit into all of those categories. I think, you know, I've actually come to believe that George Bush might believe his own rhetoric.
I suspect all of them have throughout history.
Well, Dick Cheney, I'm not so sure about. I mean, some of these guys you look at, and it's pretty clear, I think they are, they're aware that they're marshaling rhetorical cover for some pretty brutal policies.
Yeah, now, on the other hand, you had, for example, this is one of the things that really concerned me about the Democratic Party and some of our more prominent Democrats, is that in the run-up to the war, the invasion of Iraq, you had Democrats who had very serious doubts. I mean, in the House of Representatives, two-thirds of the Democrats voted against giving the president even the authority, even though it included all kinds of caveats, like he had to go to the UN and he had to have weapons inspectors and he had to come back to Congress, all this stuff, giving him the authority that might lead to a war. Two-thirds of the Democrats in the House of Representatives voted against that. But in the Senate, you had a number of Democrats who, frankly, in my opinion, because they had presidential aspirations and they thought maybe the war would go good and they wanted to share in the glory and the credit for it, decided to say, okay, we'll go for this. And that seems like the more craven, for lack of a better word, rather than the neocons who really believed that this is a way to, you know, that empire is a good thing and this is a way to make a better world.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there. The John Kerry's, the John Edwards, the Hillary Clinton's, it's not hard to have even a kind of almost a deeper contempt for their completely unprincipled stands on these matters. And I think we should pay attention to that because it's not a function purely of these individuals, of course. It's sort of built into the structure of American politics. I think we should also remember that those very same Democrats, when Bill Clinton was making noise about war in Iraq, and remember that Bill Clinton eventually did engage in his own very small attack on Iraq in 1998, a bombing that lasted a few days and was every bit as illegal as the Bush invasion.
And had Saddam responded in a big way, could have turned into a full-blown
sure.
war.
And, you know, the Clinton people were trying to do it on the cheap. And it was, of course, also on the heels of 8 years of Clinton-inspired economic sanctions on Iraq, which had devastated that society. You know, again, when we step back and look honestly at the policy of the U.S. in Iraq, nobody comes out, Democrat or Republican, smelling very good on this one, because in each case there's been a willingness to sacrifice the lives of the Iraqi civilians toward the goal of U.S. control over the Middle East. And, you know, that's the other thing we have to come to terms with is, for all the talk about weapons and terrorism and liberation and democracy, the United States, again, across Republican and Democratic administrations alike, has had a very consistent policy in the Middle East since 1945, when essentially we replaced the French and the British as the dominant power there. And that's been to control the flow of that crucial natural resource, whether it meant, you know, helping create and then defend Saudi Arabia, whether it meant switching sides with Iran and Iraq, depending on who was in charge and which country seemed to benefit U.S. interests the most. I mean, this is a pretty, I think the word you used was craven, policy across the board. And until we can come to terms with that and realize it's not a function of, you know, a particular bad leader, it's a function of a structure.
Yeah, it's and a problematic one. We're talking with Robert Jensen, the author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Robert, 1987, I was in China for a month. I studied in there. And this was back when you'd stand in Tiananmen Square and the main street there would be just an ocean of black bicycles going by. And every now and, you know, maybe every 3 or 4 minutes, a single car would go by. This was before the industrialization of China or the major explosion. And even then, some of the people I talked to said that the 21st century would be the Chinese century, that the 20th century had been the American century, the 19th century had been the European century. You know, they had this whole
right.
thing laid out. What do you think? Is the next empire going to be China?
Well, certainly if you look at U.S. policy planning, their concern is, in fact, China. We focus on the Middle East right now, but the people in the White House, and in fact, again, throughout the sort of elite strata of policy planners, are focused on China for the obvious reasons they are the threat. Now,
I'm curious to what extent we may even be fighting a proxy war with China in the Middle East over control of resources. Can you stick around for a few minutes? We can talk about this?
Would be happy to.
Great. We're talking with Robert Jensen. He's the author of the book Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. Also, if you have questions for Robert, our number 866-440-8466. It's the Tom Hartman Program, 16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Food on the table and love in the heart. And a real good woman and a couple of kids and a dog that thinks I'm smart.
Welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. Happy Thanksgiving. We'll be talking a little later about the, you know, what are the things that you're thankful for? I'll tell you, one of the things I'm thankful for is folks like Robert Jensen, who speak up and tell the truth. He's with the School of Journalism at the University of Texas. He's the author of the book Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. And, Robert, are we in the waning days of the American empire? Are we looking at the rise of the Chinese empire? Is this going to be a conflict that's going to be not unlike the American versus Soviet empires conflicts?
Well, I think the U.S. might be the last empire in world history in that sense. Certainly the talk about overstretch, overreach of empires is real. And I think the U.S. has made a very dangerous move. You know, the one thing about being the dominant power in the world is it not only allows you to consolidate your power, but with wise leadership, it allows you to change the nature of the system. And I think that was the opportunity the U.S. lost after World War II. It could have said, listen, we're in charge now, and we're going to use that power to bring into the world a new way of understanding the relationships between nations. I don't think the Chinese are going to rise as an empire in the same sense. Certainly they will compete with the U.S. for resources and markets, and that's why the United States trains a lot of its military in the long run on China, and a lot of the planning is about China. I think missile defense, for instance, which is to a large degree just a boondoggle to funnel money to corporations, does have some limited military use, even though it can't really protect us. It can be useful in threatening China and in a possible nuclear conflict with China. So we can see that planners are looking toward this end game with China. And I think the question is, can the population, that is ordinary people, say, listen, this is madness. We want to pursue a different course while we still have the opportunity before we do, as you suggest, simply kind of crater and maybe end up being the last empire in world history.
Yeah, well said. Judy in Dana Point, California has a question for you. Judy, you're live and on the air with Robert Jensen and me.
Hi, Tom. Nice talking to you. My first time calling. I'm a little nervous. I have some similar thoughts on what you're talking about. I am concerned if we don't straighten out our trade policy in another 10, 15, 20 years, we can end up like a world war, like the East with the China and the East Asian countries. Look at Japan in World War II. They were isolated. They had no oil. They had no food. I mean, they went desperate, and they ended up causing a war. And I'm really concerned in the future that if we don't get our heads together and straighten out our policies with them and our trade. Look at Canada today. They came right out and said this free trade is really ruining their economy and it's starting to ruin ours. And that's a big worry to me, and I just want to convey that to you.
Great question, Judy.
Yeah,
Thank you.
Think the trade issue is crucial because not only do we talk about competitors in the trade world, we have to worry that the trade rules that the United States and other first world nations are imposing on the third world are devastating those societies and creating instability. The UN recently came out with a report called The Inequality Predicament, in which they identify this growing inequality, not only inequality internal to the U.S., but, of course, inequality between first and third world nations. As a source of instability, it may turn out that it's not only the threat from competitors, but the underlying threat that comes when you create a world that is simply unsustainable, both in terms of justice and in terms of ecology.
So it's not just trade policy, as Judy mentioned, which is a really big one. I mean, basically, we have reached the point now where we can't build a battleship or a missile without parts from China, who has the ability to deny those parts to us. But it's also energy policy. We're in a situation where more than half of the oil that we're importing, which is the fuel that drives the engine of the American empire, is coming from outside the United States, and a lot of it, I mean, you know, a good chunk of it is coming from, example, Venezuela, a country that really doesn't appreciate our aspirations to empire.
Yes, and of course, it's again, the competition for resources and the way in which all of those policies have created the conditions you just described. But it's also the fact that by the reality of the situation is we're financing all of this on the backs of the third world. There's still a resource flow from the third world to the first world, and that can't continue indefinitely. It's not only unjust to continue to bleed the rest of the world to support this affluence, it's also unsustainable, and it's politically very dangerous. And I think, you know, the reaction of Latin America right now, the resistance to the United States, Latin America was largely pacified up until recent years when not only Hugo Chavez, but to some degree the Workers' Party in Brazil, all of these movements coming together to say enough, as you point out, and that's politically, I think, the future.
So the extent to, I mean, here we are, what, 4% of the world's population, more or less? We're consuming 25 to 35%, depending on how you define it, of the world's natural resources and the world's energy. That's unsustainable.
Yeah.
Are we looking at are we going to run headlong into a wall here, or is this going to be a slow petering out, sort of like the last 400 years of the Roman Empire?
Well, you know, the one thing we can say without too much trouble is unsustainable systems can't be sustained indefinitely. I think trying to do prediction is very difficult. Remember in the 1970s when we had books like The Population Bomb, and there was this kind of rush to prediction. When is this whole system going to collapse? And I think what we've learned is the contingencies of history are such that prediction is very difficult. I could easily imagine a situation in which there's an almost Lord of the Flies competition for survival within my lifetime. I can also imagine power continuing this way, for decades. And I think the question is, do we have the moral courage to act now?
Because if we don't act now, then our children and grandchildren are going to inherit a mess of unimaginable proportions. Robert Jensen, his book, Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. You can Google his name, Jensen. Robert, thanks for being with us today.
Always great, Tom. Thanks.
Much appreciated. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman. Looking down the nose is what people say. These are words and words, okay. It's what you do and not what you say.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We're being progressive. Never felt so good. One of the things I'm thankful for is Logan in New York City, a regular listener and caller. Hey, Logan, thanks for calling. What's up? Happy Thanksgiving.
Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, great. I just wanted to make one quick point and then ask you a question about the free trade. First, the point I heard, it was on a Majority Reporter caller. He was talking about torture, people saying that torture is necessary because they do it. And it just seems like you could then make the argument that then we should also be suicide bombers.
Yeah, or, spousal abuse is necessary because other people do it. Somebody else does it. Excuse is the most morally corrupt excuse that is conceivable.
Yeah. And I just wanted to ask you about, protectionism and these free trade agreements. It seems like you do a good job of tying protectionism to prosperity in our nation, but I think people often forget the point that these rich people that supposedly are getting rich under this Bush system might even be getting richer under a sort of Clintonian, or let's even say even a better than a Clintonian, where there's more protections in place.
You'd actually have to go back to Jimmy Carter, Richard Nixon, oddly enough, and Jack Kennedy, and Dwight Eisenhower, really. You'd have to go back to Eisenhower if you wanted to go back to a really solid trade policy that built an industrial middle class and a strong industrial United States. Yes and no. See, the problem is that during the Eisenhower years, during the Kennedy years, even during the Nixon years to a large extent, the pay and during the Carter years, during the pay of a top CEO was 30, 40, 50, maybe at the most 100 times that of the lowest paid workers. Now it's 400 times that of the lowest workers. There were a lot of societal and social protections that had to do with working, doing business domestically. You had to treat your employees with a certain level of respect and whatnot. Now you've got, sneaker manufacturers that don't make a single shoe in the United States, clothing manufacturers that don't make a piece of clothing in the United States. Their CEOs are basically living off, sucking the wealth out of America and living off the labor of people in other countries that, in my opinion, are being exploited to some extent. But even if they're not being exploited, even if they're being given a good job over there, those people don't have to account to the local community. To the workers in the local community who are saying, hey, give us a reasonable pay, give us good health benefits, what about my pension, all that kind of stuff. They don't have to deal with all that stuff because they're able to outsource those problems, and that's the problem. So that's why...
You often talk about how this process is degenerative, but you should also talk about the generative processes of having protections in place and how people might actually be... There might be more rich people, and they might even be richer under that model.
Well, actually, I'd say, Logan, there may not necessarily be richer people, but there would be a lot more people who are in the upper end of the middle class and the lower end of the boy-are-we-rich bunch. You wouldn't see as many multi-billionaires, but you'd see a whole lot more millionaires. Yes, you make a very good point. Thank you for that. Yeah, good talking to you. Robin Shanti is with us. She's with ThinkLocalPortland.org, a local group here in Portland that is doing just really great work and sharing a fine and important message that I think everybody in the United States should hear about. Robin, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks, Tom.
Robin, why is it that we should, and here in Portland, Mayor Tom Potter has declared Saturday as Buy Local Day. Robin, do you know of any other communities around the United States where politicians have done similar?
Yes, I have. We're part of a national alliance called the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which is livingeconomies.org, if people around the country want to check that out. And okay. Many communities around the country have started Think Local campaigns to really encourage people to support local independent businesses in their community. And, you know, Buy Nothing Day, the Friday after Thanksgiving, has become really popular in the last couple of years. So we took that a step further and said, you know, we totally support the idea of, you know, not having rampant consumerism in this country, especially with the holidays, but why not take this opportunity when people are out shopping to focus on how much more of your money stays in the local economy when you buy from a local independent business. So there's Buy Local Days around the country, and it's something we'd love to see become a tradition like Buy Nothing Day.
All right, so Friday is Buy Nothing Day. Take a break, spend it with your family, go to the park, relax, read a book, and Saturday, Buy Local Day. If you're gonna start your shopping, look at local vendors. Now, there are a number of really good reasons to buy local, Robin. Why don't
Absolutely.
You go through the list?
Well, first of all, it really has lessens the impact on the environment, because when you buy from a local business, they're not trucking in supplies from, you know, God knows where. So you're cutting down on energy costs. Local businesses also tend to give more to the community. They support other organizations and nonprofits. Customer service is always a lot better, because a lot of times they'll hire someone that have more specific product expertise. And really, you know, the bottom line is it leads to diversity and more choices. For us in Portland, you know...
Now, hang on just a second. You say it leads to more diversity and more choices, and yet most people would say, wait a minute, I walk through Walmart and I'm just overwhelmed by the variety and choices.
Well, a marketplace of tens of thousands of small businesses is the best way to ensure innovation. You know, one of the things we love here in Portland is you can go to your favorite local independent bookstore, your favorite coffee shop. You can go to, you know, all these little retail shops. And in the long run, they have to compete with each other. And so, you know, that brings down prices. And one of the things, Walmart, for example, there's been many studies that show that when Walmart comes into town, they lower the prices significantly. And as soon as they're there for a couple of months, they raise the prices, and it's more expensive than any of the other big box chains.
Right, and they're not the first to have done that. This is really a system that was really pioneered in the 1950s and 60s across the United States, where the big oil companies, if there was a gas station on a corner that was successful, they'd buy the opposite corner and put another one in there and try to price them down until they ran out of business. And this is how the big oil companies ran all the local independent gas stations out of business in the 60s.
Absolutely. And, you know, we're not an organization that's basically anti-Walmart or anti-chain. We're just really pro-local independent business. And our goal is to actually create a new economic model where bigger isn't better, and where the goal isn't to become a publicly traded company and be beholden to your stockholders.
Right. Now, another benefit of buying local, Robin Shanti of thinklocalportland.org, another benefit of buying local is that not only are your dollars being used to pay salaries in the local community, which is still the case with, for example, Walmart, but that your dollars are being used to support a broader infrastructure than just the store itself on a local basis, and the profits generated by your dollars are also staying local. Expand on that a little.
Sure. If you take any local independent business, they usually have a variety of service providers: accountants, lawyers, support services, graphic designers. They use printers. You know, they, if they're a restaurant, they can buy from local farmers. So you can see how the money recirculates. And as a consumer, your money, there's been many national studies that have shown that if you spend $100 at a non-independent business, only 13 of those dollars stay in your local community.
So if I spend $100 at Walmart or at McDonald's, $13, it comes back to the community in the form of taxes and payroll.
Right, but if you spend that with a local independent business, 43 of those dollars stays locally. So up to three times more stays and recirculates locally.
Now, I've seen studies back when I was in Vermont, there was a big movement to create a local currency. In fact, we had one. They still have one. And their suggestion was that a dollar spent maybe we're saying the same thing, and that a dollar spent with a local Vermont business would become, over time, over the course of, as I recall, a year, $1.47. And the reason why was because it was being deposited in local banks. Those banks then can leverage that. You deposit a dollar, they can loan out $2 or $5 or $10, whatever the banking rules are, to local other local businesses. That in addition to the things that you just talked about, that a dollar spent locally actually becomes much more than a dollar down the road, whereas a dollar spent with a national vendor becomes less than a dollar down the road.
Right, and also a lot of the national chains have a headquarters in another city, and they will buy from one big supplier and then send that to all their chains. So
right.
Most of non-independent businesses don't spend money in their local community.
Right, so at the end of the day, literally at the end of every day, every evening, Walmart pushes a button and all of their stores all around, and not just to pick on Walmart. I mean, you pick your chain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Any of these chain stores, and not just retail outlets and restaurants and everything else. They push a button and giant vacuum cleaner. All the money is sucked out of the local communities into their bank and into their banking system. The profits are then sent out to their stockholders. And whereas with a local company, at the end of the day, they walk down to the local bank and make a local deposit.
Yeah, and what's really interesting is consumers don't always realize the power that they have. And if they make the choice, you know, to just think local first before, you know, nobody's pure. And we're not saying you need to buy everything. People change their spending habits in their communities, you know, just a little bit at a time and just stop to think, can I get this locally first? Can I support a local business? It would make a tremendous impact around the country in each individual community.
So the way that people can get more information about this, Robin Shanti.
ThinkLocalPortland.org is one example of a Think Local campaign. And nationally, you can go to LivingEconomies.org to see Think Local First campaigns around the country and get one started in your community.
Living Economies.
LivingEconomies.org.
Great. Robin Shanti with ThinkLocalPortland.org. Thanks a lot, Robin, for being
thanks
with
so
us.
Thanks so much, Tom. Have a great Thanksgiving.
You too. Happy Thanksgiving to you as
bye-bye.
Well.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where we run rings around the right wing every day.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm just an old truth teller. Well, I'm not that old.
I'm your
welcome back to the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, the Tom Hartman radio program. Happy Thanksgiving, a beautiful day. Hopefully you're having a wonderful time with friends and family, and or on your way to same, or thinking about same, or just reflecting on all the things you're thankful for. I remember the marvelous quote by Meister Eckhart. I think it was in one of the comic strips today, actually, it was quoted, that if the only prayer you ever say is thank you, that's adequate. Meister Eckhart, the 15th or 16th century German mystic, who, if you've never read Meister Eckhart's stuff, get one of the books of his, you know, the translated books of his writings, just amazing stuff. Bernice in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bernice, welcome to the program. Thanks for calling 1-866-440-THOM.
I just had to call and thank you today. I mean, you're like a free bachelor's degree.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
And I've just learned so much, and I'm 77 years old and still trying to keep up with current affairs.
Well, there's a lot to keep up with. These guys are throwing so much stuff at us, this Bush administration. It's amazing.
That's true, and I didn't vote for him twice.
Yeah. Well, a badge of honor there, Bernice.
Yeah, and I can hardly wait to get my hands on this book, Citizens of the Empire. It's bringing together concepts, you know, that I knew somehow they'd connect. You know?
Yeah.
But it's just wonderful, and you're wonderful.
Well, thank you. Bernice, that's very kind of you, and thank you for calling.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you, and the same to you, too.
Right.
And thanks so much for listening there at WPTT.
Bye
now. It's marvelous. It's some of the things that we're thankful for. The folks over at Think Progress actually started to assemble a list. Some great things on here. We're thankful for our country's troops. We really are. And have been for 230-plus years. Without people serving in the military in this country, we may not have this country. We're thankful for Representative Jack Murtha for showing us that it's patriotic to speak your mind. We're thankful for 90 senators who stood up to Dick Cheney to say, sorry, Dick, torture is not an American value. We're thankful for 79 senators, keep in mind there's only 100, who demanded that the Bush administration detail a plan for Iraq. We're thankful that Bill Frist is not our doctor. I'm personally very thankful of that. We're thankful for the generosity of Americans who raised $2.3 billion to help victims of the Gulf Coast following Hurricane Katrina, regardless of the job that Brownie did. We're thankful all Americans can still rely on Social Security and hopeful that the Republicans don't get their grubby fingers on this thing worse than they already have. We're thankful for American Airlines, Verizon, and Nissan, who all agreed to drop the hammer to stop supporting Tom DeLay. We're thankful for Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald for conducting a very serious and dignified investigation as opposed to the media circus that man, Ken Starr, conducted against Bill Clinton. I mean, when you look back at what Ken Starr did, coming out with his salacious comments and his, we've got to tell you the whole story, and maybe this should be R-rated, and this is, it's just amazing. I've gotten so many emails from people over the last week because I've played several clips of, several rather extensive clips of Jack Kennedy's speeches. In fact, I must have gotten a dozen emails from people just asking me for the speeches, and I sent them out in MP3s to them. And just say, one person said it brought tears to my eyes, remembering what it was like to have a statesman leading this country as opposed to a hack politician. And another person sent me an email saying, I was only 2 years old when Jack Kennedy died. I had no idea what he was like as a president. And now you've shared these things. I've had people send me emails, similar emails about Eisenhower, saying, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, thank you for Dwight Eisenhower. You know, another statesman, a Republican. Okay, we're thankful to the voters of Colorado for putting priorities like education, health care, and fiscal sanity over right-wing ideology, turning down this whole, you know, let's stop the taxes thing in Colorado. We're thankful for autumn. Out west, where some PR readers vacation. This Think Progress. The aspens will be turning. They turn in clusters because their roots connect them. We're thankful Judy Miller won't be reporting on Iran's weapons of mass destruction program for the New York Times or, frankly, Syria's, which, as I've said many times, I think Syria is the next country that Bush intends to invade for the 2006 elections. We're thankful we don't live in Samuel Alito's America yet. We're thankful for the folks who exposed ex-FEMA Chief Michael Brown's checkered past at the International Arabian Horse Association. We're thankful for Tyshawn, the National Zoo's newest celebrity, the panda. We're thankful we're not Scotty McClellan, and we're thankful that we don't have his job. I got to tell you, I'm very thankful of that. And, of course, then there's George Bush's list. This is from Andy Borowitz. He says, let's be thankful to Brownie for doing such a good job, even if he doesn't have it anymore. Let's be thankful that we live in a place like America, not a place like China, where the doors are really tricky to open. Let's be thankful that even though my approval ratings are falling, this is Bush speaking, that they're still higher than my grades at Yale. Let's be thankful for Sony PlayStation Portable, which really helps you get through those long cabinet meetings when they're going on and on about the stupid economy. Let's be thankful that this year's almost over, and I've managed to avoid talking to Cindy Sheehan, says George W. Bush. This is from his address to the nation. Let's be thankful that John Kerry waited until a year after the election to start saying smart things about Iraq. Bush says, let's be thankful to Representative Mean Gene Schmidt of Ohio for saying cowards cut and run, but brave men serve in the Alabama National Guard, even if they don't show up. Bush says, let's be thankful that in 9 months it'll be August and I can go on summer vacation again for 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks. Let's be thankful that we have such courageous men and women working at the CIA and we know all their names. And finally, Bush says, my fellow Americans, let's be thankful that even though we still haven't brought Osama bin Laden to justice, we did finally get Robert Blake. So we have our thank list and we have George Bush's thankful list. It's interesting juxtaposition. It's 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, where we run rings around the right wing every day.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. The pill that will help you escape the matrix. Tom Hartman here with you. I am thankful on this Thanksgiving Day for so many things, for a family who I love and who I hope loves me. For the folks in our chat room, for Sue Nethercutt, who is running the thing. Thank you so much, Sue. I am so thankful for you and all the work that you do. And one of the things that I'm thankful for also is Dr. Yaron Brook. Yaron, you are one of the few people. I was having this conversation with David Corton yesterday, that you are one of the few people who comes on this program and doesn't play weasel games, but just comes right out and says what you mean. And I'm really thankful to that. Thanks for being with us, Yaron.
Well, thank you for having me on so often. It's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, you do a good job. And I'm thankful for faith, hope, and charity. You're thankful for cold hard cash. Is that a good way of putting things?
No, I wouldn't put it that way. I'm thankful for the fact that we live in a country that allows us to have a beautiful meal today, that allows us to consume the way we do today, and that allows us, more importantly, to produce so that we can consume in the way we do today. So whatever your standard of living, whatever the amount of wealth you have accumulated, this is a country that allows you to produce so that you can consume and live well.
You wrote an op-ed piece here. This holiday is designed to celebrate not faith and charity, but thought and production. And let me just go through and toss out I'll read your sentence, I'll give you my take on it, and let you react to that, if that's okay with you. We can establish a bit of a dialogue here this way. You start out by saying, Thanksgiving is an uniquely American holiday because this country was the first to create and to value material abundance. I would say no, Europe was rich, China was rich. We were the first, actually, to create a government of, by, and for we the people, where we the people would have the power of government.
No, I think that we were the first country where we the people controlled our government, where we created a government to serve us rather than us serving our government, and that is definitely a huge achievement. But by creating such a government and allowing people to be free, we were also the first country to free up production, to allow people to go out and make a living in any way that they chose, not based on some aristocrat's priority or some bureaucrat's priorities.
But if you say that we were the first to create and value material abundance, I mean, Spain was incredibly wealthy when they were bringing in all the gold from South America. England was incredibly wealthy when they were an imperial nation on a per capita basis, arguably more wealthy than the United States has ever been.
I don't think that's true. I think the United States is by far has been the wealthiest nation per capita. But the point is that we were the first nation in which wealth was valued across the board, where everybody had an opportunity to attain that wealth, where wealth was not limited to those with titles, as it was, for example, in Spain. It's true that Spain, qua country, was wealthy, but very few people in that country were wealthy. The United States is the first country in which made it possible for anybody to try to attain wealth, and indeed in our heyday in the 19th century, when this country was at its freest, poor people were as likely to become wealthy as wealthy people were likely to lose that wealth.
If they were born white and male.
If they were born white and male, and indeed over the 100 years that followed that, even that has changed to the point where today you can be female and make a lot of money, and you can be black and make a lot of money.
So then you go on to say, it is America that has become a beacon for anyone wanting to escape from poverty and misery. And, yeah, there's a lot of poverty and misery in the world. There's a lot of other countries also that are beacons and that people are trying to get into. I'd say that that was true when there was free land. We were the number one country to emigrate to during things like the potato famine in Ireland when free land was stolen from the Indians. And it's still true compared to the oligarchies and dictatorships around the world. But increasingly, the United States of America is becoming the home of poverty and misery. We have 10 million people in this country who literally, according to federal government statistics, don't know if they will eat in the following week. They're experiencing food insecurity.
Well, whether that's, I don't have that statistic, but even assuming that's true, I would argue that that is caused by the fact that we have become a welfare state. We've created a whole class of people who don't go out there and produce for themselves, but have become dependent on the government for their livelihood, and therefore become less independent and less wealthy.
I'm actually talking here, Yaron, of people who are working full-time. 11.9% of all households in America are experiencing food insecurity, and 93% of them work full-time. We're talking about people who are playing by the rules, and the rules have been stacked by the captains of industry that you champion to say, sorry, you're going to be in poverty. You may not even, you know, if you get sick, you may not be able to eat.
These rules have not been stacked by the champions of industry. These rules have been stacked by our politicians who have created a perverted system in this country.
It's the politicians who said the Delphi has to axe 24,000 jobs and reduce the hourly wage in America from $27 to $9 an hour? Pay their bonuses $90 million?
I think
their managers?
I think the minimum wage laws and regulations and so on restrict the number of people employed in this country and the amount of money overall paid to those employees. So regulations clearly restrict the ability of our business leaders to create more jobs and more wealth. And indeed, General Motors, by laying off those people, is preventing the outcome ultimately where they'll have to lay everybody off. So it's better to lay off 30,000 now than have to lay off 300,000 in a couple of years.
But the reality is, ultimately, Yaron, and you and I both know this, General Motors is really not laying off anybody. General Motors is laying off 30,000 workers in the United States and a few other countries, and probably 100,000 or more folks in China are going to be hired to manufacture and continue manufacturing. I mean, they're already making engine blocks in China.
In this case, I don't think that's the case because, you know, this is off topic, but in this case, I don't think that's the case because I think what you're seeing globally is an overabundance of automobile production. That is, there's too much capacity. And what has to happen, and some of it will happen in the U.S., but there's even talk about closing down automobile factories, even in China. There's just too many cars being made, and something has to give, and it's going to give in Europe, and it's going to give in America, and it might also give in Korea and in Japan and in China. There's just too many cars being made and too few people to buy all the abundance of cars that are being produced.
You go on to say, it is America that generated the unprecedented flood of goods that washed away centuries of privation. I would say that might have been true when America was unionized and had tariff-based trade policies, but not now. Communist China makes most of our stuff. Have you walked through a Walmart or any store recently?
Well, note that we're talking in the past here. We're talking about America's heyday, which I believe is the 19th century before unionization and not afterwards. But I think it's true of the Industrial Revolution generally. I think it's true of the United States. And even today, to the extent it's true in China, it's true to the extent that they're capitalist free and that they allow both labor mobility and capital mobility freely across the country and across the globe. I think that creates incredible wealth.
But China doesn't. China does not allow the imports of a lot of goods. They protect their domestic economy.
Yeah, let me also note that in terms of immigration, it's still true, as you know, that there's massive illegal immigration into this country because people want to come and live here because of the opportunities, because there are jobs, because there's wealth still to be created. And many of those immigrants who come into the country are much more productive and achieve much more financial success than a lot of the Americans who have been programmed by the welfare state.
The same is true of starving North Koreans who are trying to get into China. I mean, whenever you have two countries next door to each other where one, like Mexico, is run by an oligarchy, you know, 36 wealthy families and massive poverty, and the other has a higher standard of living, you're going to have pressure. But, I mean, you've got people coming to the United States because people are willing to hire them illegally.
The way it works all over the world is that whenever you have a country that is oppressed and a country that is relatively free, the people are going to migrate from the country that's oppressed to the country that's relatively free, if they're allowed to do so, or illegally if they're not. Wherever you have capitalism, people want to come and enjoy that capitalism and will try to do whatever, including risk life and limb, in order to get the more capitalist country.
Yeah, I understand your point. But just a second ago, you were using the example of China and how capital is free in China. And let's for a second say that you're right. China is a communist dictatorship. If you want to go to church, if you want to speak out against the government, you find yourself in jail for the rest of your life, if not executed. So really what you're doing is highlighting the fact that capitalism and democracy are two completely different things. Capitalism is an economic system and democracy is a political system.
No, capitalism requires democracy, and I certainly hope, that the freeing up of capital and labor in China will ultimately lead to more political freedom.
But if capitalism requires democracy, how can you have capitalism in China with no democracy?
Well, I don't think you're right. Technically, China is certainly not capitalist. Technically, China has some freedom in the economic realm and is very oppressive in other realms, and I'm certainly not a fan of China's. I'm saying that when you free people up in the economic realm, they produce, they create, they create the abundance that used to be an American feature, and now it's a global feature, which I think is wonderful.
Dr. Yaron Brook, the president of the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Yaron, I am thankful that you are always willing to come on this program and just, you know, speak your truth. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's always fun. Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. You too. Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartmann.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood, skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Indeed. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartmann here with you. Yeah, that's the world that absolutely unfettered laissez-faire capitalism will bring, and has historically. If you look back 7,000 years of history, over and over again, capitalism has been with us, and it never required democracy, in my opinion. Yaron and I, we'll go on and on about that as time goes on, no doubt. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-8466. Colleen in Coos Bay, listening on KBBR. Hey, Colleen, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom, and first of all, happy Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
And I wanted to tell you what I'm thankful for is that we have you in Progressive Radio now on the Oregon coast, and have had for quite a while. But believe me, before then, it was pretty hard listening to the Sean Hannitys and Rush Limbaughs, and, you know, just knowing there's so many people out there that think the same way that you do. And,
well, I'm grateful to our affiliates who put our program on the air, Colleen. I really am.
Well,
especially to you've got a great program director there. It's just... Well, without getting into all the inside radio talk.
Well, whenever, you know, I have different things I'm involved with here, and I do talk to them at the radio, I always thank them for you.
Well, thank you, Colleen.
And I'm thankful that I live in Oregon, and I hope that you're enjoying it. It's a beautiful place to live.
Louise and I are loving it.
And I'm thankful that, you know, the Bush administration is being found out, and all these things are, you know, people are waking up to what's really going on in the war, and hopefully, you know, it can be over long. But what scares me is, how do we survive? I mean, how do you come back after this administration? How do you ever get other countries to, you know, look at us the way they used to? And how do we be ever back on top again? Because he's done so much to destroy us.
You know, I think it's very easy for us to look at the damage that the Bush administration has done, and Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and Feith and Pearl and all these guys, and the you know, lying about the war and trying to, using the starve the beast philosophy to try and destroy the federal government so that they can, you know, turn off the spigot of social programs, what they consider to be socialism, things like Social Security and Medicare and whatnot.
Right.
You know, the loss of our reputation, the rolling back protections for our wild areas, rolling back protections for air and water. I mean, it's easy to look at all this stuff and go, oh, that's incredible. We'll never be able to recover from that. But look at Germany. Germany, during World War II, not only got a bad reputation, they went through hell. I mean, the country was bombed to rubble. You had a cholera epidemic sweeping the country during the occupation, after the end of the war, because the infrastructure was so devastated. You had a country that, you will not find a person in Germany today named Adolf anywhere. I mean, you know, it's the last name Hitler no longer exists. I mean, talk about a nation that was ashamed, rightfully so, of its past. And yet, you know, within 20 years or so, Germany came back. They got a little help from us. But basically what they did is they stood up and they said, we're sorry. You know, we blew it. We were wrong. And I think that, you know, when Bush came into office, even though they came into office with a series of lies, you know, the very first lie that the Bush administration told was that the departing Clinton administration people had taken all the W's off the keyboards in the Oval Office. And it turned out that that was a lie, that it didn't even happen on a single computer. But it got a lot of press coverage. And that was the Karl Rove, you know, that was Rove beginning his thing, right? Even though they came in on all these lies, and one of the early ones was Bush saying that you know, finally our long national nightmare is over. I think, frankly, that when the Bushies are kicked out over the course of the next 3 years, and I really believe it's going to happen in 2008, that it's going to that the Republican Party is imploding, and frankly, even the conservatives in the Democratic Party are starting to get it, that they can't play those games anymore, the corporatists, and that somebody is going to stand up, some statesman or woman is going to stand up and say, now our long national nightmare, which dates back to the rise of Ronald Reagan, trashing the idea of democracy, of saying, you know, government is a terrible thing. Now our long national nightmare is over. We apologize to the world for the harms that we've caused. We apologize to our people for the dangers that we've caused them, and we're gonna bring this country back. And I don't think it's gonna be that big. I mean, it's gonna be a big change, Colleen. But I don't think it's going to be that difficult, frankly. I mean, look at what other countries have been through, and they've made it through. We've really, I mean, you know, it's...
Yes,
it's,
this is true.
You know, it's terrible what they've done, but, we've built five concentration camps. We haven't built any gas chambers yet. We really haven't gone as far as others have gone and come back from. And I really think that it's possible that we can come back from this.
And there is hope.
Oh, there absolutely is hope. And that's the thing that keeps me doing this radio program every day.
It keeps me listening.
Yeah, and the durability, the resilience of the American people is just so tremendous. I mean, we have been through a civil war that the whole world held its breath. They thought, that's it. It's the end of the American experiment. We went through World War I, and we were never even sure why we were fighting it. We've been through, you know, some terrible misadventures, the Spanish-American War, Vietnam, and we're still here, you know, and we're still hopeful and optimistic.
I think more and more people are paying attention.
There you go. Well said, Colleen. Thanks a lot. 27.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
So just because he wasn't really elected, just because that ballot count wasn't fair, just because him and all his friends are millionaires, don't mean he don't care.
Can't say.
Yeah, that don't mean he don't
This is actually the topic of a hot debate going on in our chat room right now. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman radio program, where reason and passion go together like Republican presidents and gay hookers. Anyhow, the debate in the chat room, I've been saying that I believe that these conservatives, and Yaron Brook would not identify himself as a conservative. He would call himself an objectivist. But the conservatives are basically using the philosophy of the objectivists. That I would say that they are utopianists. And in fact, I don't even want to personalize this to Yaron or the Ayn Rand folks or any specific conservatives. Let's just talk in total generalities, because there is this notion that if it always starts with these three words, if only everybody. And whether it's on the right, the left, wherever it may be, those magic three words have led to so much death and destruction. Those magic, if only everybody would just, fill in the blank. And the people who promote those are basically utopianists. They believe that if everybody behaved the way they did, if everybody thought the way they did, then the world would be a better place. Or even a paradise. Adolf Hitler was talking about the whole rationale for the Third Reich was to create 1,000 years of peace. I don't think most Americans know that or remember that, but I'll tell you, the Germans sure did. And all about it was about a millennium of peace. And if only everybody in Europe operated their governments by and with the, by the rules of the German government and with the supervision of the German government, then there'd be 1,000 years of peace. There'd be no more wars in Europe. And you could argue that that's true. Wouldn't be a great place to live. Unless you happen to be blonde, blue-eyed, and a member of the Nazi Party. But it would be peaceful. It's the argument that the Chinese government, this is the traditional argument of dictators. Hey, if you just go along with our program, everything will be fine. And this was the big debate between, for example, Jefferson and John Adams. Jefferson was saying, let the people decide. The people will make mistakes. Let the majority, in every case, whenever possible, let the people make the decisions, because that's a self-regulating mechanism. That works the way nature works. The people will make a decision. It'll be a bad decision. They will be the ones who will suffer the consequences of it. They will correct it. And when they make good decisions, they will notice the benefit of it, and they'll do more of it. And John Adams was like, no, we can't trust the rabble. We have to have a ruling elite. We have to have a meritocracy. The big difference between America and England is that in England, it is a hereditary aristocracy. And in the United States, where the king's son becomes the next king, whereas in the United States, it's a meritocracy, where the smartest person or the most enthusiastic person or the most, whatever. Aggressive is not the right word. Competitive person wins, gets to the top. But in any case, it can't be, we can't trust democracy. And Adams, talked about this a lot. He was right up front about it. And this has been the debate between progressives and conservatives for 230 years. And I'm saying, I've been taking this position in the chat room here in this conversation, that these guys, and not just Yaron, yesterday, Tricia, who was on, who was saying, how dare you call my president a liar. And I'm like, he is a liar. How dare you do that? I really believe that the vast majority of them actually believe what they're saying. And they really believe that if everybody would just get with the program, we would have a better world. And that they just haven't bothered to look at history. They haven't bothered to dig a level deeper. And the reason that I can say that is because I've been there. I've told you before, when I was 13 years old, 1964, I went door to door for Barry Goldwater. In my heart, I knew he was right. In the 60s, I got into liberal politics, and I got into SDS and the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement. And then after that, I got into business in the early 70s, and I thought being a libertarian was the way to go. I still have a bumper sticker on a filing cabinet at home that says, vote libertarian, freedom works. And, you know, it just because it sounded so good. Gee, what a common sense thing. Let's just let the free market take care of everything. If everybody follows their own selfish instincts, ultimately, everything will sort itself out. Well, tragically, that's not the case. History tells us that's not the case. But there are a lot of people who believe that, from John Stossel to Yaron to, you know, on and on it goes. And it's just there is, in my opinion, a small number of people. And this was our conversation a while ago with the historian, with Robert Jensen. There is a small number of people. And tragically, I think many of them are in the Democratic Party. A lot of them are in the Republican Party. At the level of national politics and local politics as well, I deal with this in the local program here in Portland, there are a number of people who are in politics who take positions because they think that that's the position that's going to get them campaign contributions, that's the position that's going to get them power. And there are some people in the media who are sucking up to the right wing because that's where the money is. I mean, you know, I know that with the you know, for what it's worth, and I don't mean to blow my own horn, but with whatever writing skill I have and whatever speaking skill I have, if I wanted to become a right-wing pundit and write right-wing op-ed pieces and right-wing books, I could make a lot of money. They're, you know, starting pay at some of these right-wing think tanks, $100,000, $150,000 a year. You want to write for a left-wing site like I do, Common Dreams or Buzzflash? The pay is zero. And, you know, it's a rather noticeable difference, right? Rather noticeable difference. But, and so there are some sellouts out there. And I'll give you that. I'll tell you, know, I absolutely agree that there are some sellouts out there. But, and occasionally we'll get somebody on the program who gets outed as a sellout. But frankly, I'm not so interested in talking to the sellouts. I want to talk to the people who really believe. When they look in the mirror in the morning when they get up, they look in the mirror and they say, you know, this conservative way of doing things, you know, let the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, because eventually it'll motivate the poor to get to become rich. And in America, everybody can become a multimillionaire, even though they really believe that, because they've never bothered to think it through. They've never bothered to look at history. They've never bothered to do the math. They've never bothered to get out there and shake hands with people in poor communities. They've never bothered. They've never had the experience of working as a waiter in a diner in a small town in the South. They've never had that experience. I really believe, based on my experience in life over the years, that at the end of the day, pretty much everybody, with very, very few exceptions, and those few exceptions, I think Dick Cheney, frankly, is one of those exceptions, but I think by and large, and you can see the dissonance, because one side of his mouth goes one way and the other side of his mouth goes the other way when he talks, and when you see that in a person, you know that they are thinking one thing and saying another, right? But with the exception of those very few people who are just essentially intentionally dissonant, intentionally lying, I think that most people have rationalizations that allow them to sleep well at night. And then there's a whole industry out there devoted to giving them those rationalizations. And those are the people that are really toxic. And those are the people that we need to be outing on the program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Sean in Orcas Island, Washington. Hey, Sean.
Hey, Tom. I think that you are the best radio host on the air.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And I wanted to just comment on Dr. Yaron Brook.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in school, I took a course in human awareness psychology. And what I hear from him and people like him that sometimes you have on the radio is this voice inflection that sounds like there is a disconnect between their head and their heart. And I don't hear the compassion, the frequency of compassion, and the frequency of human awareness. It's a very interesting, you know, it's my personal opinion, but that's what I hear.
Well, and Sean, you got to be really careful about that.
I mean,
Ted Bundy was so convincing. So convincing.
But, you know, there's a book out. I hope that you have it, and if not, I'll send it to you. It's called America, Fascism, and God by Davis and Lohr.
It's sitting on my desk at home, yeah.
Yay. He's incredible. I read the whole book yesterday to my husband and myself, and it's just really amazing. And there's a lot going on now that I think we all have to be so aware of. And I really thank you for having these authors on and these different people that are doing really good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Sean, and I appreciate it. Thank you for your call, and I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
I hope you do, too.
Thank you.
All right.
I intend to. Okay, bye now. In fact, Louise is sitting right here with me in the studio, and we're going to go out and visit with some friends for Thanksgiving afterwards. But, Sean, the point that I would make is that I wouldn't judge Euron by his tonality. I'd be very, very careful about that because, as I said, there are some people who, you know, the sociopaths among us who Euron by his tonality. I'd be very, very careful about that because, as I said, there are some people who, you know, the sociopaths among us who Ted Bundy and company who can be so incredibly convincing. What was his name? The guy who just got convicted of killing his pregnant wife in California that they made the whole hoop-de-doop about for a year and a half.
November 25th at 5 a.m., November 25th.
Say that again? Okay. there are sociopaths, and you have no way of knowing because they're so good at imitating empathy, at imitating that they actually have emotions and they actually do care and they're actually there for you. And
November 25th.
And then on the other hand, there are some folks who just, you know, you can't tell. You just can't tell. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There are sorrows enough for the whole world's end. There are no guarantees but the grave. And the lives that we live and the times we have spent are a treasure too precious to save.
And welcome back, my friends. 8 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Definitely not. Folks in the chat room, it's not Tom's nature to get nasty, although they were thrilled when Dick Morris hung up on me. Thank you. Thank you, Shireen. And somebody says, you know, I'm being too nice to these people. No, I'm really not. I'm really telling you, you know, I know people like this. I'm related to people like this. My parents, as I've told you, my parents have a picture of you're just misinformed. And you know, in their 70s, they're not interested in being reinformed. And so I've given up on trying. But, I mean, there is a certain point at which you have to say, you know, okay, we're not talking about politics over the table here. And it's just... There is a philosophy out there, and there are people who are pushing it to get this thing out. Val in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, on the line. Hey, Val, welcome to the program.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment, first of all, that I really believe, after reading Mark Crispin Miller's book, this is a holy war, and I really can't understand how the Graham family considers him born again. But aside from that, I have a young soldier here, and she wants to give you her interpretation. My granddaughter is so frightened. She told me she'd like to just take her life. She doesn't want to go over there until she feels duped into this. Here she is. Her name's Melissa.
Yes, hello.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi. I'm a soldier in the Army, and from my experience, it's just horrible. Training is horrible. They won't let anybody go. There's a lot of young girls that want to kill themselves, and it's just
In other
horrible.
Words, you can't, by let you go, you mean you can't get out of the military.
You can't get out at all. Usually, you can get out for just one Article 15 for drinking. Now you can't even get out for that. They'll just keep you in and they'll tell you to go on and train.
Right.
And there's just no way out. Like, some girls are diagnosed with depression and they still won't let them out. They just keep them in there, give them pills, and that's illegal. They're not supposed to be doing that.
Yeah, you know, having been in the military during Vietnam, I can tell you the situation is not all that different. And the hope that we have, Val, is that John Murtha's message is going to get out there. And frankly, all the indications are that the Republicans were intending to pull down the troops right after the first of the year because this is killing them in the elections. And Melissa, I'm sorry, and Melissa, I would bet just about anything I have that by 6 months to 9 months from now, we're going to see half the troop levels in Iraq that there are there now, and the rest of them are going to be redeployed into places that are relatively safe, into the bases that we've built around there,
mm-hmm.
because it's just not working. It's just not working. And the furor that you're seeing, I mean, you watch the American press and you get all these right-wingers going, oh, no, we're not going to, John Murtha, he's a traitor, blah, 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 blah. What they're really upset about is the fact that the Democrats trumped them, that the Democrats came out and said out in public, out loud, 3 weeks before the Republicans intended to, what the Republicans were going to say.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that offers you any hope. The military can be a marvelous career, and there's a lot of fine people in the military, and this Iraq war is a disaster. And frankly, I don't think that the American involvement in the Iraq war is going to survive beyond the 2006 elections.
So, I hope not.
Yeah, I me too. And I thank you for being willing to serve your country and for joining up, and I empathize with your concern. I don't have any specific advice on how to get out of the military. I'm sorry. Have you talked to the folks associated with the Quakers, the Society of Friends?
Oh, no.
You might want to contact the Society of Friends. I believe it's friends.org. I might be wrong, but you can certainly Google them. The Quakers are the ones who historically have worked with war resistors and people in the military and helped them figure out how to get out or how to not get deployed into war areas. And it might be a good source of information for you if at a personal level, Melissa, if you're really concerned about this.
We're just all tired of the lies that they tell the young soldiers. I'm only 18, and there's a lot of people like me that just go for money and their family, and then they tell them our motto is to kill and destroy the enemy, and it's just horrible with the things that come out of their mouth. They make everyone killing machines. And I do not want to kill anybody, no matter how bad they hurt us. I cannot kill anybody.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you should definitely be talking with the Quakers because, the whole conscientious objector thing is what they're all about.
Mm-hmm.
And and you might want to also talk to the folks at Gold Star Families for Peace, gsfp.org. They may have some suggestions for you.
Okay.
But I wish you the best, Melissa. And Val, thanks a lot for the call, both of you. And I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.